This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. Actually, this week, the Compass is anything but local. In fact, this week the Compass is taking you far, far to the south, to perhaps the most biodiverse and critically endangered rainforest in the world, the one known as the Choco. So now, let's go inside the Compass. In the early morning of July 8, 2012, about a month after his 30th birthday, my nephew Jevin Newman died after extensive surgery in the intensive care unit of the hospital in Little Rock, Arkansas, where about a week earlier he had started his medical career as an emergency room resident. Jevin was the victim of a sunset collision between his bicycle and a large pickup truck. In multiple memorial services in far-flung places, Jevin's many friends spoke of the inspiration his headlong, fun-loving, and adventure-filled life bestowed, and many promises were made to keep his spirit alive by following his free-spirited example. For Jevin was never one to allow studies to get in the way of adventure and fun, which to him included things ranging from windsurfing in the North Sea to streaking across the field at a University of Colorado football game to saving the tropical rainforests. Jevin was always one to do things his own way. When it came to his passion for the rainforest, for example, he was not one to simply make a donation to the Rainforest Action Network or to Amazon Watch. No. While Jevin was in Ecuador, volunteering in a rural clinic in an effort to earn the credentials that would overcome his somewhat shaky academic record and gain him entry to medical school, he sought out a prominent rainforest ecologist to advise him where he might find the most biodiverse and critically endangered rainforest in the world. Then, he personally bought as big a piece of it as he could afford, close to 200 acres of pristine old growth in the Choco, the lush rainforest that once extended along the western slope of the Andes from mid-Ecuador through Colombia to Panama, but of which only 2% now remains, with the intention of saving it from logging. Earlier this year, my sister Alita and her husband Joe finally succeeded in getting title of that land into the hands of Raul Nieto, who was the rainforest ecologist Jevin had consulted for his purchase. And when my wife Monica and I heard that they were going to make a pilgrimage to Ecuador to visit Jevin's rainforest, we decided to join them. And so it was that one warm equatorial afternoon in November, we found ourselves jolting along a rutted gravel road on the edge of Puerto Quito, Ecuador, after a four-hour van ride northwest from Quito, the capital, following Raul's dusty pickup truck back from the center of town where he had come to meet us, to the modest cement slab-built hacienda where he has lived and experimented with rainforest restoration and sustainable cacao and coffee growing for 25 years. Slight of build with unruly salt and pepper hair, Raul is self-effacing, and it was only after several days in his company that I came to fully appreciate what an extraordinary man he is. Of course, there was the thing that had attracted Jevin to him in the first place, which is that Raul is the founder of the Itapoa Reserve, a non-governmental organization that not only presides over the conservation of several hundred acres of primeval Choco rainforest, but which also concerns itself with restoring the forest to clear-cut areas and training cacao farmers to raise their crops in a fashion that's compatible with the forest, and then to help them realize enough profits from their crop that they're not forced to supplement their income by cutting down trees. It was only much later that we learned that, in addition to his conservation work, Raul had also founded a primary school in Puerto Quito, including hiring teachers whom he often paid out of his own pocket. He said that it was this kind of generosity that eventually led his wife to legally separate from him, to save some of what they had, as he put it. She now runs a hostel out on the coast in Puerto Lopez, in which they remain partners, and he says he spends about half his time living there with her. Raul is a natural-born educator, as we quickly learned when he gave us a two-hour tour of his 12-hectare plantation and forest, a small part of which is old growth, but the rest of which he has restored over the past 25 years from a clear cut to a tall, lush forest, with some areas planted in cacao or coffee. He never stopped lecturing on the whole walk.
Now, these plants are local. They had evolved next to streams or lakes. They are dispersed by birds, by mammals, and they take advantage only of the light, you know, the extra light and the less humidity, because once you cut the forest, all this changes, all the ecosystem is disturbed. Like the temperature, when you have a forest, doesn't fluctuate too much. It goes in this area, the minimum 20 Celsius and the maximum 25. Yeah, so it doesn't go too low or too high. But if you cut down the forest at night, it could go lower, like to 18 or 19, and during the day it could go up to 32 or even 35 some days. And native trees of the forest don't do well there because they evolved under these conditions.
After our walk that first afternoon, we sat out on crude wooden benches on Raoul's wide covered second floor terrace, basking in the warm tropical breezes and watching brightly colored birds flitting through the plush foliage, while Raoul lectured us on the history of the demise of the Choco rainforest.
The agrarian reform actually was part of a U.S. program called Alliance for the Progress to fight that communism. And it was an idea of President Kennedy, where he thought that by helping people in these countries, they would not go communist. So he started this program that had three major roles. One of them was to give donations to the poor people directly. The second thing was the Peace Corps. And the third thing was the agrarian reform, which is a Marxist principle, and it tells to take the land or part of the land of the rich people and give it to the poor people. Okay. However, the rich people in Ecuador were the politicians, so they were never going to give that, you know, their own land to the poor people, and they opened the jungle. And to each family, the government gave 50 hectares. And in order to get the title of property, they had to clear cut 50% of the forest. Otherwise, the government would take the land back and give it to somebody else to do it. So thousands of families came to the Chocó here in Ecuador, and the whole jungle was divided in pieces of 50 hectares. And right after that, logging companies came to help, you know, cutting down the forest, to help the Ecuadorian families. Now, for the settlers, that became a very easy business. They would come here, wait for the logging company to arrive, sell the wood, and not only 50% of the forest, 100% in many cases, go to the government, say, okay, we have cleared down the forest. The government would give them the title of property. And now, with the title of property, they could sell the land that was given to them for free by the government, and they went deeper into the forest, and they did the same thing. So most of them, most of the settlers just found a business. Well, that law ended in 93, so there was no more pressure to cut down the forest. And also in North America and Europe, they began to ban precious wood from being imported. And that kind of stopped all this, you know, madness of just cutting down for, you know, the forest for nothing, and the logging companies began to just get semi-precious wood for plywood, and mainly to deal with indigenous communities, because they could bribe the leader of the community by giving them a house or a car. And then convincing or telling this leader to convince the people that it'll be in the benefit of everybody, because they will have to build a road, and finally they will be able to sell their products to the cities. But the jungle people didn't have any products. Their only product they have is forest. So finally the forest was clear cut. Anyway, now that there is almost no native land left, even, you know, I mean trees. So now they are going back to deal with settlers. And these logging companies even have legal issues for human rights violations. They have been involved in killings of settlers that oppose them from coming through their land. And they have taken paramilitaries, you know, to these regions to scare the others, try to convince them, you know, to just allow the roads to go through and sell the wood. So the only solution is to buy the land from settlers that are also they're just waiting, you know, for companies to come with good prices for the wood, and try to make these private protected areas.
Another pressure on the forest came in the form of African palm plantations, valued for the oil derived from their fruit, which is used for everything from cosmetics to soap to processed foods to, more recently, biodiesel.
African palm was introduced to Ecuador in 1971, right after the beginning of the agrarian reform, because African palm grows well in lowland rainforest, and that was what was being clear-cut. Then, in the early 2000s, there was this artificial demand on biodiesel from Europe, because since Kyoto Protocol, where they concluded that if CO2 emissions were not lowered down by 40% by 2020, global warming would become irreversible. And they began to plant more and more African palm, thinking that that was going to be the petroleum of the future, because eventually everything was going to be replaced by biodiesel. And why not in Europe? Because here land was cheaper, labor was cheaper, and also very little labor regulations. A hectare of African palm produces 40% more oil than a hectare of soybeans. And soybeans, you have to keep planting them every year. Yeah. And African palm, you plant every 20 years.
Ironically, when the fuel costs of planting, harvesting, processing, refining, transporting to Europe, and distributing to fueling stations are added to the loss of the environmental services of the ancient rainforest when they are replaced by relatively short-lived African palm plantations, Raul estimated that palm oil-based biodiesel increased the carbon load to the atmosphere by about 900 times, utterly defeating the purpose. The next day, Raul invited some friends and colleagues over to meet us and give us a chocolate-making demonstration, among them some students and teachers for a school of traditional indigenous music and dance he is launching, along with primatologists Felipe Alfonso Cortez and Natalia Fuentes, who are focusing their work on saving the last of the critically endangered brown-headed spider monkey, a canopy dweller endemic to the Choco. While the others ground dried cacao beans to make the chocolate in the background, Felipe spoke to me about that effort and his organization, Proyecto Washu.
Washu is the name of the brown-headed spider monkeys in an indigenous dialect. And the brown-headed spider monkey is one of the most endangered primates on the planet and is the most endangered primate in Ecuador. Their habitat is the Choco. The Choco call it a hotspot because it's a high endemic. This kind of habitat has a lot of biodiversity, but it's also really threatened because there are a lot of deforestation. And we focus now in an area that it calls Tesoro Escondido. Tesoro Escondido, it's 3,000 hectares of forest that owns to local farmers, and the farmers in Tesoro Escondido are mainly cacao farmers. So that's why we, with the people over there, we started to make like this community engagement to the conservation actions to protect the spider monkeys.
What are these farmers doing that threaten the forest currently?
The problem is that cacao doesn't have a high price, and they start to cut the primary forest to grow more hectares of cacao, and that's unfair because of the market, because cacao has it depends on the stock markets, and when you see all,
so it's a commodity on the stock market.
Yeah, exactly.
But you were telling me before that actually Ecuadorian cacao is of higher quality, right?
Yeah, cacao Ecuador now has this variety of cacao that it calls national cacao or cacao arriba. So that it means that with this kind of cacao you can make high quality chocolate bars. And now they have a huge demand of this cacao because it's like the wine. If you want the best, you will look into the chocolate
bar.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And But that's why it's so unfair, because Ecuadorian national cacao, it has a really huge price when you see a chocolate bar, but the price that it pays for the farmers, it's very low. So within Proyecto Washu, we started to work with the farmers to improve their cacao quality and to look direct buyers, to reduce all the intermediary buyers.
But, so you're taking out the middlemen.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, the middlemen are the ones that make the price of the cacao lower and lower. And
so how are you going about doing that? I mean, how do you cut out the middlemen?
First, we always started to make workshops with chocolatiers that show them how to improve their cacao quality. When we have that, we know that we have high quality cacao, and we reach the buyers directly. There are little chocolate companies in Europe and United States that are looking for this kind of histories, that they know that it's going to be in a fair trade chain, and also the story behind that. If you are going to buy this kind of cacao, you are protecting the forest, because the families with we are working now, they sign an agreement with us in which our responsibility as Proyecto Washu is to find these direct buyers, and their responsibility is to stop, continue deforestation and protect the forest that they have now.
Cortez and Fuentes later showed us a short animated video they had created about their project, which they said they were going to put up on the crowdfunding website Indiegogo under the title of Choco Project. In the late afternoon, as the equatorial sunset quickly faded to darkness, the musicians and dancers entertained us with traditional marimba music and dances that Raul said were all but lost, but for his and a few others' efforts to save them. Then it was off for an early dinner and early bedtime, for the next day was to be the arduous trek to Jevons Forest. It was still completely dark when the little van Raul had hired set off with its 9 passengers, which included Marie and Maria, 2 of the dancers from the night before, who are regular guests and helpers in Raul's household, and who are also the very dark-skinned descendants of African slaves brought to Ecuador centuries ago by the Spaniards, and who now consider themselves indigenous. A young man nicknamed Primo, who is the other kind of indigenous, and whom Raul said he trusted more than anyone in navigating the rainforest. An athletic friend of Joe and Alita's from the psych department at the University of Wisconsin in Madison named John Curtin, who happened to be in Ecuador for sabbatical, and whose skills as a long-distance runner would come in very useful later in the day. Raul, of course, and us 4 family members. Nelson was our driver. My knees were already sore from rubbing against the seat in front of me when the van turned off the main highway onto the terribly rutted and pothole-filled dirt road that we were to lurch along for the next 4 hours to reach the banks of the Canandaigua River, a total distance of only 40 kilometers, but what seemed endless to my severely compressed body. As the morning light came up, the depressing reality of Raul's talk about palm oil came clear. All around us, for hour after hour, was almost nothing but African palm plantations.
All this flat area was one of the richest forests in the world.
Sure.
And now it's all African palm.
It was with great relief that we finally arrived at the tiny bare plank shantytown where we were to meet the canoe that would take us up the Canandaigua to the point where we were to start our hike. But when we arrived, the boatman had already departed with another customer, and so we waited for more than an hour, a delay that would ultimately cost us. On the bank of the river, a couple of men guarding a raft of newly cut lumber eyed us suspiciously. The lumber, Raul informed us, was illegally harvested old growth. The canoe, when it finally arrived, was built of similar stuff, long, clear, rough-cut planks. We all clambered aboard. A stout man standing in the bow pulled us out into the current, and the small outboard chugged to life. The flats of the palm plantations were now replaced by steep mountainsides that plummeted down to the valley bottom, and we could see that the flanks of the mountains were covered in a lavish layer of greenery. We had finally arrived at old-growth rainforest. Whenever we arrived at a rapid, which was often, the boatman required us all to get out and walk while he pulled and gunned the little engine to push the boat upstream. After about an hour of this in and out, the canoe finally came to rest at a muddy bank with a well-worn trail leading across a wide clearing towards the mountain. This was the route to Jevons Forest, we were told, and tightening our pack straps, we set off across a young cacao plantation towards the forest. The going was tough. Raoul had warned us that it would be muddy, and he had loaned us all rubber boots for the hike, but I don't think any of us were really prepared for the knee-deep sticky muck we would be walking through all day, where at each step there was a serious danger of having your boots suck right off your foot, as happened almost immediately to Alita, who was walking right in front of me. We started to climb, but we hadn't even reached the tree line when we stopped for our first break. Standing amidst the carcasses of recently cut trees, we shared a bag of chips.
And we are going to see lots of trees cut down recently. Some of them are being stolen, actually, from other neighbors. Yeah, somebody's coming here to steal the wood.
And I guess there's no way to guard against that, or
it's a bit dangerous here. You know, you could get killed if you didn't know anything. You know, people normally here, what they do is hire a hitman. That's how they solve the problem.
Are hitmen easy to find here?
Yeah, they are very easy and cheap. You can find one for $500.
But if you can trust them?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Most of them work with the police. Yeah, so I don't know.
So it's a dangerous business getting into trying to preserve land.
Yes, it's a little bit dangerous. So you don't actually confront them. What you try to do is work around and educate people and try to, you know,
change the
laws or things like that. If you denounce them directly, it's very dangerous.
A little bit later, we were finally walking in the true forest primeval, the canopy high above almost totally obscured by the lavish undergrowth. But in the jungle, the path became even worse, a steep, slippery, muck-filled trough. The group spread out according to abilities, with the experienced guides far ahead and those of us less fit trailing far in the rear, which twice actually turned out to be lucky, for those of us in the rear caught a glimpse at one point of the endangered long-wattled umbrella bird, which, with its comical mop of head feathers, looks for all the world like a Dr. Seuss character. And a bit later, we heard a rustling in the trees high above us and looked up to see a brown-headed spider monkey swinging from tree to tree. But just when you would start to think we had finally arrived in the heart of the true jungle, we would find another clearing with slash lying all about. And then, after we had been slogging up the steep slope for more than 2 hours, we came to a sight that Raoul called heartbreaking, an enormous ceiba tree of a species Raoul called bambuto, lying on the ground, the victim of poachers, cut into planks and several enormous beams, a tree Raoul remembered because it was close to the edge of Jevons Forest.
So they actually mill them in place here with chainsaws?
With chainsaws.
The whole base of the tree is there.
This is really like heartbreaking.
Okay, yeah, it's a beautiful tree.
That's called bambuto.
Bambuto?
Yeah, it's a kind of a saber tree.
Unbelievable. Unreal that they can do the fine milling out here. It's too bad.
Considering the difficulty of the muddy trail, it was hard to fathom how anyone could have possibly gotten any wood out of such a remote location, but Raoul said they used burrows. The saddest thing was he estimated that the poachers would only receive about $300 for a tree of this size, but that once the expenses of renting burrows and hiring the chainsaw operator were figured in, the profit was only a few bucks, if anything. And so it was in a rather somber mood that we finally arrived at the corner of Jevons Forest, which was demarked by a bold sign that I asked Raoul to read out for me to record.
El letrero dice Reserva Biológica Itapoa. Protegemos la biodiversidad hoy para conservar las especies y tener aire puro y agua limpia para nuestros hijos y los hijos de nuestros hijos. Itapoa Reserve, Jevon Newman Forest, Ministerio del Ambiente.
Group photos were taken, and then we pushed on without stopping for lunch. We were falling behind schedule, and Alita and Joe wanted to get to a beautiful waterfall they had heard about on Jevons Land, where they had plans to hold a small ceremony and spread the last of Jevons' ashes, which they had saved for this trip. Getting there meant that we no longer were following a trail exactly, but rather just a slash along the property line, a roller coaster of deep gullies crisscrossed by fallen logs. In one place we had to make a wide detour through dense jungle after Primo, who was in the lead, spotted a wasp nest. Later there was a log featuring bullet ants to cross. The jungle was dense, dark, and tall. We passed another bamboo tree all hung about with vines that must have been 15 feet across at the base, thankfully still standing. And then, disturbingly, we came to a small clearing.
Okay, this piece of land, you see the clearing, it was being invaded, squatted by some people a couple of years ago. And Don Bailon took care of that. And, yeah, so we got rid of them.
Invited them away.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why it's growing back.
This is where you might put a lodge if you were going to put a lodge.
Yeah, I'd put it here. Yeah.
The sky darkened and it started to rain. The terrain got rougher and steeper, up and down again. When we finally arrived at the stream, we were well below the waterfall, and it was already 3 p.m, so we gave up on making it to the waterfall. Instead, we all took seats on rocks in the middle of the stream right where we were, and with the rain still gently falling, out of the silence we spoke messages about Jevon.
I have to admit, I'm starting to feel like a little bit of an old lady climbing up these hills. We all fantasize that we can stay young forever, maybe, I don't know. But Jevon actually went a long way to helping us stay young, you know? I can hear his voice yelling at me sometimes for being a wimp, for not following closely enough on the bicycle, for not taking some of the advantages of what we do have. So anyway, thank you very much for being here, for helping us, for making this possible for us to come. I was wishing I could tell other people how magnificent it is to come, but this one pain in the ass to get here. Which is maybe what's going to keep it safe.
Yeah.
But I really, I love it. Thank you.
Well, thanks also. Yeah, I really feel also grateful for you sharing this with me. We were friends, but not really close friends. It seems that it was some important link between us with the forest, and I thank you for trusting me, you know, by holding the forest and now trusting me by bringing you here, even though it's like, I know it's hard, but you make it.
This is so beautiful.
It is amazing.
As we spoke, we passed a bag containing the remains of Jevon's ashes and dropped handsful into the rushing water, which briefly turned a milky white in the pool around which we sat. We gave Jevon our solemn word that we would all do what we could to protect this special place, and then, reluctantly, we departed, still without breaking for lunch. It was only at this juncture that Raoul revealed that he had never taken the return route he now proposed to take. Now, I won't bother you with all of the details, because it's obvious from the fact that you're listening to this story that I at least survived. But I will tell you that wrong turns were taken, that darkness overtook us in the jungle on the mountainside, that we encountered venomous snakes, that we had a shortage of flashlights, that we missed our appointment with the canoe to take us back downriver, and so had to ford the Canandaigua River in the dark, that John and Primo then ran down to the village to summon Nelson in the van, which promptly got stuck in a ditch, so that we all had to walk out an additional 2 miles before bumping 4 hours back along those terrible roads to Raoul's house in Puerto Quito and bed. It was a real adventure, one of which my nephew Jevon Newman would have been proud. This is Steve Evans reporting from the Shoco Rainforest for KPTZ Compass. This week's KPTZ Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans. The Compass airs Mondays and Saturdays at noon, Tuesdays at 5 p.m., and Wednesdays at 10 a.m., exclusively here on KPTZ, the home of eclectic, authentic community radio. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.
Mm-hmm.